Good afternoon. It's just after 3:30, and you're listening to Local Motion here on KVNF, your weekly source for what's happening in your community. I'm Travis Bubinick. Dr. Clifford Sarin is an associate research scientist with the Center for Mind and Brain at UC Davis in California. His research looks at the psychological and physiological effects of meditation and other contemplative practices, in particular meditation's effect on attention span and emotion regulation. His main research project is entitled the Shamatha Project, where these effects were studied during a three-month intensive meditation retreat in the small town of Red Feather Lakes in northern Colorado. He speaks tonight in Telluride at the Palm Theater, alongside other researchers in the field of what is being called the science of compassion. The talk is part of a summer research institute hosted by the Telluride Institute and Stanford University, a four-day conference aimed at supporting up-and-coming scientists whose research focuses on compassion, mindfulness, and altruism. Dr. Sarin, thanks for being with us today. Without diving too deeply into the science of the Shamatha Project, could you give us a general idea of the cultural or perhaps the social objectives of your work?
Sure. I think that many people today feel a variety of stresses that we're actually in the habit of accommodating rather than truly dealing with and changing our behavior that might result in greater well-being. And my colleagues and many individuals around the world have been understanding these over the last decade or so, that there really are very strong relationships between our psychological states and our physical health. And we live in a time where many of us are constantly wired, connected, feel the guilt if we don't answer an email within seconds or a text. We're compelled to text and drive because of the immediacy and also the sense of somehow missing out on what's happening. So there's a need, I think, in society to recalibrate what it means to be able to establish a real ongoing sense of well-being within the framework of modern life. And so our project really is rooted in examining quite ancient claims that have been borne out in the experience of many of us, that spending some serious time in contemplative practice results in a kind of refresh and resetting of values and priorities and the acquisition of qualities of mind that really can deal with many of the exigencies of the stress of daily life, as well as really come to the forefront when transitions that are very difficult to deal with enter our lives. Loss of loved ones, chronic or catastrophic illness. So overall, I think what we're asking is, can attention be trained? Does training of attention facilitate emotion regulation, sort of not getting pulled in every which way direction when something doesn't quite go the way we thought it would? And whether these together result in the generation of qualities of mind that facilitate pro-social behavior.
You mentioned to me when we spoke briefly yesterday that here in 2013, we live in what is now a global village. So I'm wondering how your work can help us cope or address that new reality that we're living with.
Well, that's a really fascinating and important question, because there are two sides to the fact that we are so instantly aware of what happens, often of tragedies, calamities, suffering all over the world. And one of the important things, I think, to begin to understand is a little bit of the sort of experiential anatomy of what happens when we experience the suffering of another. One of the things is that we become somewhat distressed ourselves often. There's a wonderful neuroscience research by Tanya Singer that shows that if you get a shock to your or a pinch to your hand, and you're in an MRI scanner. The pain network in your brain lights up regions of the insular cortex and the cingulate cortex. It's called the pain network, where your body representation is aligned with things that are strongly affective in their activation, and pain is one such thing. That same areas, those same areas light up when someone close to you experiences the same kind of pain. So we have an evolutionarily important ability to simulate within our own brains the states of others, including states of pain. Sometimes we confuse whether that's another person's pain or it's our pain. And now we have a problem. We have what's called empathic distress. Empathic distress now leaves someone needing to feel better in order to be re-engaged with what's happening around them. And often they engage in activities to distract themselves or soothe themselves. And now they're no longer engaged with the conditions of suffering in someone else because they have their own pain and they have sort of lost the distinction between understanding initially through an empathic response the pain of another, and now they are in pain. So there needs to be a way to increase the awareness of not suffering because of other people's suffering. That's going to actually inhibit pro-social engagement, because now you have to take care of yourself before you can even begin to take care of someone else. When we are aware of calamities around the world, we have almost a constant stream of catastrophic events. Yesterday, the front page of the New York Times tells us 22 school children in India died because cooking oil was put in a can that had been used for insecticide. And this is what I'm learning with my morning coffee. How does one hold this and not be in despair? Because we know that we're only seeing tips of icebergs through this global stream of information. Well, there may be a whole host of internal skills, if you will, to understand the complexity of life and that it is not fair, that it is our comforts and privileges are so not uniformly distributed. But nonetheless, there is buoyancy and pliancy and joy in daily life that can be used to help you find what one can do without sort of being flattened by the reality of suffering in the world.
So, speaking about these internal skills, how might the practice of meditation or other similar contemplative practices, as some people in the field call them, how might these directly enable us to access these skills of compassion and of understanding suffering?
So I think something very important is simply at the outset is to understand that meditation does not equal practicing one specific technique, but really could be categorized as a class category of efforts designed to help you become more familiar with the way your mind operates. And there are many different approaches and schools and spiritual traditions and religious orientations that can be brought to bear on the cultivation of a sense of what your mind's like. But in general, in order to know your mind a little better than you do now, you need to stop what you're doing and observe it from a place of relative quiescence or stillness. You also need some basic level of attentional skill in order to be able to develop the observational capacity to observe changes in yourself that might arise as circumstances around you change. You know, we're all very good if you're living at home and you're somebody brushed quickly by a picture that might be hanging on your wall, at some point you'll notice the picture is hanging off kilter. You will stop, you will focus on it, and then you will make a careful adjustment and check that in fact it's straight and level again. So that moment of leveling the picture is a really good metaphor for what one can cultivate as an internal skill that allows you to reset and observe processes inside that might cause you not to be able to be as skillful in relating to what unfolds in your life as you might. So in the context of our project, to get back to the research, we set out to examine how intensive meditation. These were 2 3-month retreats that we ran at the Shambhala Mountain Center in Red Feather Lakes. And they were taught by Buddhist teacher, practitioner, scholar Alan Wallace, who's written a number of books about Buddhism. And the meditative techniques that he taught are described in a book he wrote called The Attention Revolution. And these basically involve learning to stabilize your attention. Shamatha literally means calm abiding. And the instruction might be as simple as pay attention to the tactile sensations of the breath at the tip of the nostrils for a period of time, say 24 minutes. When your mind wanders, gently bring it back to the sensation of the breath when you notice your mind has wandered. If you do that time and time again, you're actually in a training environment of redirecting your attention to a chosen object. Along the way, you're getting to observe the sorts of things that come up in your mind. That might be ruminative thoughts, they might be sensory distractions, they might be sensations in your body from the posture you're in. And in the course of repeatedly bringing your mind back to this simple, neutral object, you slowly develop a sense of attentional stability. You do this within a framework of relaxation, not really a framework of trying to achieve something. And also a vividness of perception can arise. If you practice this, when you get up from the cushion, you may notice that you have an emotional reaction to something where you wouldn't have noticed what triggered that emotional reaction. Now you kind of have a kind of almost time lapse or a slow motion perception of your mental processes. So you can catch bits and pieces of your mental life that were formerly outside your awareness. That doesn't say that you become aware of every unconscious aspect of your life, far from it. But you can become sufficiently aware so that you may notice choices that you could make in how to respond when different emotions arise by playing a few moves down the chessboard of life, if you'll allow me that, and suggesting to yourself to act in a way that may be more skillful than you might otherwise do. You also might notice if you're spending additional time cultivating genuine wishes of beneficence for yourself and for others, such as loving kindness, the wish for others to be happy and to find the causes of happiness, compassion, which is what we're focusing on this week in Telluride, a sense of empathetic joy that, you know, how often in circumstances does the success of another person really cause joy in one, as opposed to envy, jealousy, an activation of a sense of competition. And finally, a sense of equanimity. And equanimity is really a profoundly important piece of these aspirations, because it really situates those close to you and those far from you on an equal playing field. It diminishes the tendency to draw a circle of compassion close to oneself and to actually make the boundaries of it more porous. So if you balance a kind of introspective awareness, focused attention training, with cultivation of positive attitudes and beneficent aspirations for yourself and others, I think one of the things that can come out of that, and our data bear this out, is that one can now encounter the suffering of others with less of an automatic tendency to defend against it, and less of a tendency to sort of just simply merge into it in despair. There's more buoyancy and thoughtfulness, because actually, if you experience a genuine wish to relieve suffering, that can't arise if you're feeling despair. A genuine wish is something that is actually has a positive affective tone, even in the presence of understanding conditions of suffering.
So, taking a step back from the psychological and the emotional complexities of really diving into this this awareness of suffering in the world and this willingness to confront it and to accept it and to appreciate it, really, taking a step back from how involved that is for the human mind and the human soul, I mean, it seems almost implied that a calm mind would be a caring mind. So how does science, and your research in particular, how does that help us to understand how we can go about, you know, achieving this level of compassion for others? Or how does it explain to us how that occurs through meditation or through contemplation?
Well, I think that it's really important to understand that these are early days for research on compassionate action and its training and cultivation. And we ultimately have to proceed with experiments that investigate real behavior in the world. For instance, there was an op-ed piece in the New York Times a couple of weeks ago about meditation actually helping us be more moral beings. And that was a study that one of the co-authors of which, Gail DeBoards, is a faculty member at the Compassion Summer Research Institute in Telluride. This was a case in which individuals were randomly assigned to receive a meditation training across an 8-week period or not. And then they entered to a laboratory waiting room to be tested, what they thought was for something unrelated to actually what the experiment was about. And when they came to the waiting room, there were 3 chairs. 2 individuals were already seated, and they sat down in the empty chair. Shortly after they sat down, someone struggling with crutches, obviously in pain, entered the room. The 2 people already seated down did not get up to give their seat to the person obviously in pain. So the person who'd come for the experiment was faced with a choice: do I give the seat or do I not? The really depressing news is that the group that did not get meditation training, only 16% of those individuals actually gave their seat, while 50% of the individuals who had undergone the meditation training gave up their seat. That still says that half didn't, but it's a striking improvement.
The event you're speaking at tonight is a part of a partnership between Stanford University and the Telluride Institute, among others. And I'm wondering if maybe you could offer us some perspective on why Telluride? What is it about the Telluride Institute or the people and minds living and working in this area that has drawn this field of study and this dialogue to this area?
Well, there's a specific reason is that there are individuals who are working at the Stanford Center for Compassion Research and Altruism who have family ties to individuals at the Telluride Institute and living in Telluride. And so there was already a collaborative framework for goals of the Telluride Institute that are consonant with goals for the Stanford Center for Compassion Research and Altruism and Education. The idea for the Summer Research Institute in Compassion was sparked by a conference that we held last summer in Telluride. And that conference was an outgrowth of a compassion festival in Telluride the previous year. So there's really been a wonderful welcoming, and there's a very strong sense of caring and stewardship, I think, in Telluride that is supported by efforts of many individuals, the Telluride Institute being the one that is the collaborative connection to the Stanford Center for Compassion and Altruism Research and Education, CCARE.
Well, Dr. Sarin, it's been a pleasure speaking with you. Thanks for joining us for Local Motion here on KVNF, and best of luck to you and all your future research.
Thank you. It's really been a pleasure, Travis. Thanks for having me on.
We've been speaking with Dr. Clifford Sarin, a research scientist with the Center for Mind and Brain at UC Davis in California. His main research project is entitled the Shamatha Project. Dr. Sarin and other researchers host a panel discussion tonight in Telluride at the Palm Theater from 8 to 10 p.m. The talk is entitled The Science of Compassion, News from the Front, and the event is open to the public. Thanks for tuning in to Local Motion today. You can hear conversations about issues, people, and ideas that affect your world every Tuesday from 3:30 to 4 p.m. For KVNF, I'm Travis Bubinick.